So a little bit of background just to remind you, for those of you who are perhaps joining our series in 1 John, or perhaps you just forgot. 1 John. So the Apostle Paul went to that southwestern corner of what we now call Turkey to do evangelism. And the Lord, in his own words, Paul says, the Lord opened an effective door for the gospel. People's hearts opened. They believed the things that Paul taught them. And disciples were made. People became Christians. They became Christians. Remember becoming a Christian? And having become a Christian, they began to form themselves and were being encouraged to shape themselves into groups of Christians, which has got a very special name. They're called churches, gatherings of earth. And that the relationship between all of these people in these little new groups of people who'd come to trust in Jesus, well, they had fellowship with each other, didn't they? They had fellowship. They walked through life together, through the thick and the thin of it, all as Christians. And Paul, obviously, his mission was to move on to other places and to do the same thing in other places. And if our understanding is correct, that the Apostle John, the writer of this letter, then came subsequently to that into the same area. And we know that from the book of Revelation, for example, we meet John many years later in that area, working in that area. And there are at least seven churches, principal churches, that he's been encouraging and nurturing and helping to grow in their faith. But it's interesting that the Apostle Paul, on his last journey through Ephesus, which is the kind of the hub church, if you like, from this little network of congregations, he gathered the elders from the various different churches together, and he issued a warning to them. He said they had to shepherd the flock, which meant that they had to be responsible for the direction and the leadership and the care of the church. He says, because there are wolves coming. Wolves. And it's interesting, when you get to the book of Revelation and you read the profile of the seven churches, one or two of them are doing pretty well. But there's other ones, and there are wolves at work in the churches. And John, the writer in our letter here, has used a term to describe the experience, the phenomenon, the thing that's happening. He says, in his terms, the spirit of Antichrist is already at work. Wolves. So here are the people of God growing in their faith, these new churches, and this other spirit is active and at work, and it's unsettling the churches. Now, when we get to 1 John, this is written before the book of Revelation, so it's early on, and it's at the point at which these fellowships, these congregations, who've taken their stand for the gospel, are beginning to experience the, you know, wolves tend to circle around the flock and pick off the ones on the edges, pick off the lambs, pick off the weak ones on the edges, nip in and try to take a snatch away. And that is starting to happen. He's conscious. There are these people, they've been walking together, they've been serving together, they've been sharing faith and fellowship with one another. And now, instead of fellowship, that fellowship is getting fractured, that fellowship is getting broken, people are departing, people are leaving, they're starting to profess other faiths, other professions, other doctrines, other beliefs. We know, don't we, from the book of Revelation, there was the Nicolaitans and all these different views and opinions getting in and getting under their skin and separating people. And that love, that primitive Christian love that had existed amongst them, from all the references we find about brothers hating each other or loving each other, that love is starting to turn sour in some places. Relationships are getting strained. There's friction, there's tensions, and some of the truth of it is that as these frictions and tensions and anger and resentment and bitterness are growing, that love is turning to hatred in certain places. Now, John, when he writes the gospel, he is trying to bring people to faith, to bring them into the church. When he writes this letter, he's writing to Christians to stop them leaving. Don't go. There are wolves. There's another spirit at work. Beware. And he takes these Christians back to first principles, doesn't he? The first principle. And this verse, God is love, we've heard it twice in this reading, haven't we? He repeats it again. If you go practically anywhere and you ask people what they understand by God, we're talking about way outside of Christian circles, right? Just in the marketplaces, in the ordinary streets of things. And what their basic understanding or appreciation of who and what God is, people will say, that's their basic belief, is God is love, right? That truth, which it surfaced, we've just seen the place where those words have surfaced in Scripture, and it's gone out into all the world, like we were hearing, like the words of the heavens, it's gone out to the ends of the earth. So this truth has gone out to the end. God is love. And you know what, like, 90-95% of people's objections, frustrations, disappointments, lack of faith, hostility, resistance, rebellion all comes from the fact that they believe that God is love, and yet the circumstances of their life and the things they experience and the people they meet and all the rest of it does not seem to add up to that love. If God is love, then why? If God is love, then how? If God is love, then when? And in that space, in that place, they are vulnerable to wolves. Because their confidence, their faith, their trust in God, the God who is love, is being eroded by their own understanding of the circumstances and how they believe this God really shows this incredible love. In the passage we're looking at here, we're offered three things. There's knowledge, there's reliance, and there's life. Those three things we're going to look at in sequence in a moment. But the point is, God is love. If I took a piece of string or a thread and I tied a stone onto the end of it and I dropped it out of my hand, the force of gravity would draw it absolutely down to the center of the earth, wouldn't it? It's being attracted to the absolute center of the earth. So you know for certain that particular line is pointing directly. You have got as close to an earthbound vertical as can exist. It's a plumb line. In the same way, if I take a right angle off of that, you have got an absolute horizontal. As far as the earth is concerned, that is an earthbound horizontal. You've got a vertical, you've got a horizontal. Those things are true. They are true, faithful measurements. But you know, even then, there are very, very small, slight distortions in those measurements. I think somebody was telling me the other day that when the French decided to make regularize the meter, that they sent a team out to do all sorts of measurements around the place, and they basically came back with this meter. And from what I understand, the meter, which they've got a platinum meter in Paris somewhere, and that is the absolute meter from which all other meters are measured, and there's a slight error in it. It's slightly false, and yet all of our measurements are based off of ever such a slight falsehood. People are fascinated by, like, if you go to places like Peru, those massive megalithic stones and stuff like that, that wonder how did all these stones fit together? You can't hardly get a cigarette paper between them two. How did they even do that? It's so close together. So what I'm saying is that even the horizontals and the verticals, the meters and the closeness, the exactnesses of our measurements, which are so important to us, aren't they? To be able to measure things properly and accurately. From everything else we try to do, we need to have exact measurements. John is saying, God is not like love. It's not just a question of like, it's almost exactly, you know, God is like this and love is like that, and they're very, very close, like two pieces of megalithic stone or stonework. It's not, he is love. You literally can say, this is the gold standard of love. This is pure love. Absolute pure love. No alloy, no distortions, no errors, absolutely exactness. And every other love is measured against God. Human love, human affections, human desires. And the fact is that all other loves are warped, distorted, they've got errors, they've got flaws, they're imperfect. There is no love like the love that is not. Not just the love of God, the love that is God. So when we talk about the love of God, we're talking about that pure, pure love. Absolute love. Perhaps you've had people saying, where is God? Let him show himself. Or you can ask them, where is love? Let it show itself. And the thing about the love of God, that kind of love, that kind of pure love, cannot be kept secret. It's not hidden away somewhere. Love in its pureness has to be on display, has to show itself, has to be demonstrated. And you can see in the heavens above the love of God in everything that is made. But as John keeps reminding us, if you want to see it in its absolute purest, unaffected, unalloyed way, look at Jesus. Look at him. He gave his one and only Son. Those are John's words too, aren't they? That whoever should believe in him should not perish but have everlasting life. Perfect love, pure love, unconditional love. Love for sinners, love for flawed and broken people. Not the worthy, not the righteous, not the healthy, the sick, the sinful, the broken. That's all of us. If you will just find the grace to accept it, to believe it. This incredible love, this pure love. And John says that it's possible to know this love. You know, some people talk about this idea that love, you know, God is transcendent. He's up there beyond reach and power. And there are some religious theologies in some other religions. And even it has crept its way into Christendom in its widest sense. That's this sublime love. No, you can know the love. You can know God. You can know God. You can know about him. He's more than happy to be known. He wants you to know him. He wants you to know about who he is and what he's done and what he's like. He wants you to know his character. He wants you to know all about him. And then eventually, I mean, these are just the things that we need to know of him in this world. The day is coming. He wants to know you absolutely and completely in the only place where that's possible, in his very house, in his eternal home, in his eternal habitation. He wants you to be there with him and to know him, completely know him and be known by him. Amazing, isn't it, to think about this? The God who made you wants you for himself forever. Not in some greedy, pathetic human way, possessive way, but pure love. The objects of his absolute pure love. And you can know about it. You can know about it. And it's good to know about it. But you know, when oftentimes the word knowledge or knowing here is used, especially in the scriptures, is pushing us a little bit further than just knowing about something. It's an experience. You know, when you've had an experience and you know about something, you know it by experience because you've been there, because you've done that, because you understand it from the inside. That kind of knowledge is possible. You can have an experience of God. You can experience this pure, perfect love. You can know God. It's mind-blowing. But lots of people like know about him and perhaps even have some sort of experience of God. But John goes on. He says, and we know and rely. And this is where faith comes in, isn't it? You know, some people, they find the love of God, God himself, so foreign, so other. Do you remember when the manna came down out of the sky in the wilderness and they all this food came down on the ground and they looked at it? Do you remember what they called it? They called it manna, didn't they, right? You know what that means? What is it? It means what is it in Hebrew. They kicked it around. It's like buying a secondhand car. What is it? Is this any good? Is this good to eat? Is this going to do me good? Is this healthy? They were suspicious. Yeah, so people know they have this experience of God, but they are so alien to love. They have so little real experience of this kind of love that they encounter it and they just don't know what to do with it. And they're suspicious and mistrustful of it. They wonder, is this a trick? Is this a scam? Am I being punked here? But he's saying, you can know about it, but we have come to rely on this love. Because guess what? Sorry, that's a horrible American preacher's term. Guess what? The world can be a loveless place. You can find yourself in a network of relationships that are entirely conditional and entirely transactional, and your worth is only measured by the degree to which you serve somebody else's ends or purposes. And if you fall beneath the line of usefulness in one way, shape, or form, so the affection withdraws. You may take a position or a stance on something that is disagreeable to others. Maybe it's not even a position or stance. Maybe it's the color of your skin. Maybe it's where you were born. It's the accent on your lips. Maybe it's your background and your blood. Whatever it is, you can know what it is to be hated in this world. There is real evil at work in this world. There is real hate at work in this world. And when you find yourself entirely unloved and isolated, you can rely on the love of God, and he will fill you up. He will fill you completely. He will satisfy you so that you can say, I don't care if you don't like me. I don't care if you don't understand me. I don't care if you don't know me. I just don't care, because honestly, I am happy in Jesus. Are you happy with Jesus? Is he enough? Are you filled? God is love. And he's given us his Son. We've come to rely on it time and time and time and time again. When you fail, when you are conscious of your sin and your shortcomings, and you look to God expecting that frown or judgment or criticism, and he smiles at you. And he loves you. And he talks to you. And he hears your cries. And he settles your heart and puts you back in the right place. Gives you a word of correction, perhaps, but in a way that just you can accept. You come to rely. Over time, you come to rely on the love of God. What would we be without the love of God? Perish the thought. Perish the thought. Where would we be going without the love of God? Perish the thought. Perish the thought. Wolves. So we've come to know it and love and rely. We've come to believe that God, remember the testimony we heard here in baptism last week? I've come to believe that he loves me. So important, isn't it? So we've gone from knowing to relying and then finally living in the love of God. Living in the love of God. I suppose you've all that relying is quite life-changing, isn't it? You start to draw in that love. And clearly what John is saying to these people, it's not enough just to draw it in. You've got to then give it out. Thank you, our preacher for this evening. Appreciate it. Give it out. It starts to go through you, come out of you as you're changed. You start to love the unlovely. Forgive the sinners. Forgive the hurt. Forgive the harm. You start to be a little bit more understanding, a bit more patient, a bit more kind, a little bit more joyful. You might stop being quite so miserable because of the love of God. And it starts to change you. And it starts to become your life. You know, there's a thing that people go to church. You get to a point where you have moved past the whole idea of going to church seems like a nonsense. What do you mean, go to church? I'm caught in this inextricable web of God's plan and design that has set me into his body forever as an organic part of an eternal body that is going to live in glory forever. I am part of the church. And we meet and we fellowship with each other. Go to church. You are the church. And yes, there are people who are coming to the church. And the love of God opens our hearts to those people and welcomes them, sometimes in all their confusion and their filth and their misunderstandings and misapprehensions and frustrations and disappointments. And by grace, we walk them into this incredible love. The end goal here, the end goal clearly, and so we know and rely on the love God has for us. God is love. And I love that verse. Whoever lives in love, lives in God and God in him. What does living in God and God in him look like? These whoevers. Like I assume you're all a whoever. Anybody here doesn't fit the category? If you do this, if God lives in you and you in him, what will you end up looking like? You end up looking like Jesus. You become more like him. I think it must be the highest prayer of every Christian, that I might be a little bit more like him. Is that your chief desire? Your highest goal, your wildest dream, your greatest aspiration, that there just like be more room for him in me and more of me in him. And somehow, some mysterious way, the love of God is manifest here on earth. Your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. A bit more like Jesus. Lord, help us.